But then as they sort of began to sweep south along this strategic M5 highway that links Aleppo and Damascus, I think it kind of ignited something. Turns out that even in supposedly pro-regime parts of the country, very few people were willing to sacrifice anymore. You know, we're looking at somebody that was able to shed a group like Al-Qaeda, remain alive, and not just remain alive, but take over Damascus.
Hey, welcome back to the Modern War Institute podcast, brought to you with the generous support of the West Point class of 1974. I'm John Amble, and on this episode, we're talking about the pretty remarkable events that have unfolded in the past few weeks in Syria. For well over a decade, the regime of Bashar al-Assad managed to hold onto power during a civil war that has pitted a number of rebel groups against the regime and has been marked by the intervention of an array of external actors. Some, like Russia, Iran, and Hezbollah on Assad's side, and others on the side of the rebels. And then, after a lightning offensive by rebels that seized a series of Syrian cities and ultimately led them to Damascus, Assad was gone, and more than a half century of rule by his family came to an end. To explore how that happened and what comes next, I'm joined on this episode by Natasha Hall, a senior fellow with the Middle East program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies with deep expertise on Syria. Before we get to the discussion, a couple quick notes. First, a very special thank you to the West Point class of 1974 for their generous support to MWI. And second, as always, what you hear in this episode are the views of the participants and don't represent those of West Point, the Army, or any other agency of the U.S. government. All right, here's my conversation with Natasha Hall. Natasha, thank you so much for joining me on this episode of the MWI podcast.
Thanks so much for having me, John.
So I think I mentioned to you when I reached out to invite you on the podcast that since the fall of the Assad regime, I had read articles about it that in which you were quoted. I had seen you talking about it on TV. You're also, I just noticed yesterday or the day before, you're quoted on the Wikipedia page for the fall of the Assad regime. And I mean, this, you know, I think is a pretty good indicator that you have some pretty sought after insights. And I thought, you know, it would be great to kind of have you to have a longer form conversation and dig into some of the dynamics surrounding the collapse of this regime. So to start, you know, nothing is permanent in geopolitics, nothing is permanent in statecraft. And so in that sense, it's not really a surprise that this regime, that any regime would eventually come to an end. But for well over a decade, this is an individual, a regime that managed pretty ruthlessly to survive, and you know, including at some times when that did not look necessarily all that likely. And then seemingly out of nowhere, it comes to an end. So I guess my first question is, you know, was it in fact that rapid and that out of nowhere? Or were there indicators, perhaps even before this sort of two-week lightning offensive by rebels that captured a succession of cities and ultimately Damascus, were there indicators that this might be in the cards?
Yeah, I think that is the question, right? And I mean, I've been covering Syria for 15 years, so I was living there, you know, sort of prior to the revolution happening, right? And, you know, what I would say about especially the past few years is you saw the powers that be, and that was, you know, Assad's allies like Russia and Iran, but it was also, frankly, the United States and Gulf states and other countries that had actually previously supported the opposition to the Assad regime, who also had kind of decided that Assad was victorious. Now, them deciding that Assad was victorious, I don't think necessarily meant that he was victorious in, I think, the sense that we all think of, right? Someone who has legitimacy, strength, can, you know, hold their sovereign country together. I mean, this was a dictator who, you know, still did not have access to, you know, 30% of his territory. That included about 70% of the oil wealth and agricultural wealth of the country. Rather than really defeat the rebels that fought him, he kind of pushed them to the side. So there were these mass displacement events throughout the past decade, basically pushing people either out of the country altogether. We saw the biggest refugee crisis since World War II coming from Syria, but also pushing everyone else kind of to this Northwest enclave. And this is where we saw the rebel offensive sweep out from in the past couple of weeks. So I think that, you know, essentially it was a house of cards. I mean, I think that if you had been talking to Syrians over the past few years, and I'm talking about people that weren't politically minded, weren't, you know, necessarily opposed to the regime, were frustrated. I mean, it was really difficult to live in Syria. There was very little electricity. You know, regime cronies would just walk around towns, you know, demanding bribes. It was very much a mafioso kind of state. And I think at the end of the day, once Iran was weakened, and hopefully we can talk about why, and Russia as well, you know, it turns out there was very few people willing to fight for him and to keep this regime in place. Turns out that even in supposedly pro-regime parts of the country, very few people were willing to sacrifice any more to maintain this regime that, you know, has been in power for over half a century.
So those are two sort of parallel and maybe intersecting dynamics, right? The loss of external support from Russia, from Iran, and then also an unwillingness on the part of the people who have to fight for this regime to continue doing so. And, you know, I guess I want to ask about one or about the two of them in turn. In terms of external support, how instrumental was that maybe in the early years, especially because, you know, during the Arab Spring, we saw regimes toppled in Tunisia and Egypt, and we saw civil war break out when Gaddafi fell in Libya. All of this happened pretty quickly. And in Syria, there was something different. He managed to not only hold on to power, but to pretty ruthlessly crush this anti-regime protests, the demonstrations, and stay in power for a long time. Even going back to that point, was Russian support really what helped him do that? Was Iranian support really what helped him do that?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm actually writing a book now on sort of Assad's lessons for regime survival, which is going to need to change a bit, which is probably a good thing. But the Russians were absolutely instrumental to Assad's survival for a number of reasons. I mean, you already had Iran and Iranian-backed proxies like Hezbollah sort of helping on the ground in the early years of the war to besiege numerous parts of the country. And those were extremely effective because the rebels were never given air power. They were never given sort of these man pads, so sort of portable air defense systems. And so it was, you know, it was a slaughter. I mean, it was a massacre because basically once these rebels had liberated certain areas, the Assad regime was literally just dropping, you know, old empty barrels of oil, but now filled with sort of crude explosives and shrapnel onto people. And it was fine because, mm-hmm. I mean, it wasn't fine obviously for the people on the ground, but it worked because there wasn't really that much support for the opposition on the ground. Even with all of that, by 2015, the Assad regime was still flailing. It had lost control of vast swaths of the country. It still could have toppled, right? And surely without Iranian or Hezbollah support, it would have definitely, I think, toppled much sooner. But I think in 2013, when Assad first used sarin gas on his people, and Russia sort of came to the diplomatic rescue to save the regime from itself and force it to, you know, promise to get rid of chemical weapons. Turns out they didn't, but at least it stopped a U.S. intervention there. But then really crucially, I think in 2015 came in with just incredibly superior firepower with sort of these Russian Sukhoi jets. And I was there just after the Russian intervention. I can tell you from Syrians on the ground that they had never seen anything like it. They had sort of developed early warning systems, but those were primarily for slow moving helicopters. And then these fighter jets just came through and just annihilated everything in, you know, a few hours. And so there was not much that anyone could do after that. And in addition to that, I think it made sort of more external intervention in the conflict less feasible because a nuclear power had essentially just entered the fray.
So that's what Russian support looked like. What did Hezbollah and Iranian support mainly look like?
Yeah. So the way that I sort of describe it is the Russian support was actually very cost effective. I mean, this was a very cheap war for them. They were essentially trying out weapons in on the Syrian battleground, which is awful to think about, but that's essentially what was going on. They lost very few people. They had Wagner's forces. These are the sort of Russian mercenary forces on the ground. But Iran and Hezbollah really put in sweat and blood and really tens of billions of dollars by some estimates into rescuing the Assad regime. So they've lost a lot. And they were essentially on the ground to sort of reinforce, I would say, the regular Syrian military, because listeners might know that early on in the war, there were already a lot of people that wouldn't fight and die for the Assad regime. So we saw mass defections. And this is what essentially created the Free Syrian Army, or the sort of new rebel groups. And so, you know, Assad needed to shore that up with something else. And so you saw Iran and Hezbollah shore up those ranks with various proxy groups from Iraq, but also all the way to Afghanistan.
Well, you mentioned also, I talked about that sort of second parallel dynamic to the external stakeholders, external intervening forces, is the sort of lack of will on the part of Syrians to continue to fight for the regime, because there were moments from 2011 onward where they did, and they kept the regime in power, whether or not that's sending helicopters up and dropping the barrel bombs that you described, using chemical weapons. There were people that were willing to heed those orders. Why were they not anymore?
Well, I think that there's some aspects of the offensive that come into play here. But again, I think this is more about the house of cards, the sort of Pyrrhic victory of the Assad regime. Towards the end, government employees are making about $25 a month because the Syrian currency collapsed. You know, I think we all think of the Alawi religion sort of sect in Syria, which is Bashar al-Assad's sect, as being very, very pro-regime. And that's certainly the case to a certain degree, because Assad really stoked sectarianism, made Alawis think that their existence was dependent on him. But they've suffered immeasurably during this war. I mean, they have lost many, many men in this war. And so I think, you know, no one was necessarily supportive of the regime or pro-regime, but they all felt like they had to fight for him for their own survival. But I think once they saw that Russia wasn't going to come to their aid, once they saw that Iran and Hezbollah simply couldn't, I think they knew that their time was up. And apparently Bashar al-Assad did too, pretty quickly.
Do you think the leaders of the various rebel groups, anti-regime groups, also saw that pretty clearly?
I think that they did. There was certainly a lot of planning that went into this offensive for the past few years. And then really critically, I think in the past few months, and a lot of people hadn't been paying attention to Syria anymore. So they were surprised, but HTS was telling pretty much anyone that would listen that they were going to conduct this offensive at some point.
Really?
And so I think, yeah. And I think that they saw sort of a moment, you know, a couple of months ago, where there was sort of a confluence of events, essentially. So you saw Israel sort of decimate Hezbollah's rank and file and decapitate its leadership, but really critically also continue to hit arms shipments coming from Iran to Lebanon. So basically any kind of, you know, Iranian linked arms shipments. So that made it very, very difficult for Iran and Hezbollah to kind of come to the rescue. And you saw the offensive actually launched just several hours after the supposed ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah, though it hasn't been much of a ceasefire. We've seen Israel continue to attack those shipments. And then you also saw Turkey and Russia really pushing the Assad regime to compromise a bit. In particular, you've seen Turkish President Erdogan, you know, reaching out trying to reconcile with the regime. People might not know, but Turkey was kind of like the headquarters or base of the Syrian opposition for many years. And there had been a lot of challenges to his own regime by opposition parties that were seeking to normalize with Assad. So he felt sort of the need to keep up and make declarations about the return of millions of refugees and things like that. Turkey hosts one of the largest populations of refugees in the world. And, you know, those talks once again fell apart in early November. And I think the Kremlin was frustrated, frankly. Ankara was certainly frustrated. And so I think Ankara essentially gave the green light for this and then used their own sort of hodgepodge of militia groups that's under this umbrella, Namakur, the Syrian National Army in the north, the SNA, to try to get as much as they could in the vacuum of power. And so we have seen clashes continue before a U.S. brokered ceasefire just a couple days ago, continue between sort of Kurdish armed forces in Syria and these Turkish-backed forces as well. So I think it was just this sort of confluence of events. It was also, you know, just the fact that everyone had kind of forgotten about Northwest Syria. You know, it was this purgatory for a lot of people that, you know, over a million people still living in camps. And so I think they seized the moment, essentially.
You know, anybody who's kind of watched this knows that this isn't a, you know, a sort of bifurcated civil war where you've got the regime on one side and anti-regime forces on the other. It was a really, really complex landscape of groups with competing agendas, competing ideologies, external actors supporting their own particular, you know, their preferred flavor of proxy in the country. Was it a surprise to you to see HTS, obviously, you know, be able to do this, but also to kind of put together almost a coalition of groups that had not always been working well together necessarily throughout the war?
No, because all of those groups were united in being against the regime. And earlier on, yes, you did see a lot of infighting, but that was instigated by many different forces. Some on purpose, some not so much. So you had the Saudis supporting their people, the Qataris supporting their people, the U.S. supporting their people. But all of those groups, their intention was to fight the regime. Now, what actually ended up happening on the ground in places like Eastern Ghouta, which was besieged for years, was, yes, you of course saw infighting between these groups under really, really difficult conditions. Because that's what happens during a war, right? You have when there's deprivation, when there is a struggle for resources, very limited resources, you end up seeing infighting. And HTS in particular has, for many years, been by far the most disciplined and independent of the groups. The SNA has ended up being a bit more thuggish, very undisciplined for the most part. And, you know, at times just mercenaries for the Turkish government working in places like Nagorno-Karabakh and the Southern Caucasus and in Libya, other places where Turkey has influence. And so, you know, and then, of course, you also have the Kurdish forces that have their own ideas about autonomy. And there was certainly infighting, I would say, even within the Kurdish community as well. So certainly, you know, that began to happen as the war sort of came to the fore, right? It became a more violent situation. But that said, you know, it was very clear that none of these groups were necessarily wanting to fight for the regime.
But is it accurate to characterize this as an HTS-led offensive?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, this was quite clearly an offensive that was, I mean, the charge was led by Abu Muhammad al-Jolani. I don't know if we're still using his nom de guerre, but the SNA actually kind of held back and continued to fight the Kurds. And al-Jolani actually tried to get them to focus on the regime, but, you know, they don't have much power over those SNA factions, so...
So how involved were other actors outside of HTS in the actual fighting?
Yeah. So primarily it was HTS. I should note that some of the armed groups that were displaced from other parts of Syria to the northern and northwestern parts of the country, some of them were absorbed by the SNA, but some of them were absorbed by HTS over time. So, you know, HTS sort of remains a somewhat of an umbrella group. But what was fascinating is that after HTS took Aleppo City, which is the second largest city in Syria, in a day, which is just incredible for anyone that's been watching Syria for over a decade. It took the regime, you know, a year of bombardment and siege and chemical weapons to take just eastern Aleppo City. So that was incredible. But then as they sort of began to sweep south along this strategic M5 highway that links Aleppo and Damascus, I think it kind of ignited something across the country where people felt like there was this momentum that couldn't be stopped anymore, especially once they took Hama City, and then they just kept going southwards, and it looked like they were going to take Homs City. And then by that time, you saw groups that used to be composed of the Southern Front, so armed groups in southern Syria, suddenly come alive again. You saw the SDF taking advantage of the situation and taking a border crossing, a really vital border crossing for Iran on the Iraqi border, and just sweep into these regime-controlled cities in the east in a place called Deir ez-Zor. And you actually saw, and I don't know if this was organic or planned, certainly in Aleppo City it was. I don't know if it was planned in places like Hama City, but men just not even able to wait for the rebels and going up to regime checkpoints with guns and just, you know, telling the regime to basically leave. And so once that momentum was created, you just saw these spontaneous uprisings everywhere with, you know, all these groups and communities trying to expel security forces from the area.
So to the extent that we could say somebody is in charge right now in Syria, presumably that's Gilani.
Yeah, I would say it's Jolani. We've also seen a man named al-Bashir, who was the sort of one of the leaders in the Syrian Salvation Government. So this is the sort of nominal civilian wing of HTS in Idlib. And, you know, it appears that they have sort of taken control of the existing government apparatus. They've said that will only be for 3 months. Just to sort of stabilize the situation, plan for a transition government and things like that. But that all kind of remains to be seen.
Are there still sort of, I guess maybe you could almost call them fiefdoms of various militias, various rebel groups that maybe haven't yet sworn fealty to HTS? Is there, I mean, is this not over yet? Is there still going to be more fighting if the state is going to sort of reemerge as a sovereign entity?
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly a lot will depend on whether or not U.S. troops withdraw. There's still about 900 U.S. troops in northeast Syria and eastern Syria. And without them, the Syrian Democratic Forces, which is composed of Arab groups, but they have a lot of tensions with Arab communities, but it's primarily dominated by Kurdish authorities. And if the U.S. leaves, there is certain to be a lot of infighting because, as I mentioned, the SDF controls, you know, most of the natural wealth of the country. So this is certainly a prize. So there will be infighting there. There will continue to be infighting between sort of Turkish-backed groups and these Kurdish groups in the north, unless there's some kind of, you know, more sustainable peace agreement, I think, between Syrian Kurdish communities and Turkey. And then, you know, with HTS, there's, you know, it remains to be seen if they're really going to hand over power to a civilian government, I think, in a real way. Jolani has said that he wants to dissolve HTS and just build up the actual Syrian military. So all groups coming together, I think that's the dream or the ambition or the goal. But the reality is that it isn't clear if HTS, and we can talk about, you know, their interests and ambitions and belief system as well. But even if they were perfect, whether or not they could keep others in line, because, you know, I mean, Syria is awash with weapons. So we've been seeing some retribution killings. And we have seen some pro-regime forces sort of taking a stand and trying to exploit like the last bit of that they can out of Syria, basically for amnesty or for goodies. So I think there's still a lot that needs to be worked out.
Yeah, that's one of the things in terms of HTS ideology and Jolani specifically, because, you know, there's been a lot of attention paid to some comments that he's made where, you know, that's going to respect, you know, ethnic religious diversity in the country. And it makes him sound like a Syrian nationalist, not necessarily a leader in an Al-Qaeda affiliated group, which he was with Jabhat al-Nusra. I guess how real is that in your estimation?
So I think we can't really know. What we do know is that Jolani is pragmatic. We do know that he has been trying to actually negotiate with Western powers for many years, put on a more moderate face to the West in particular, that designates HTS as a terrorist organization and apparently still has a $10 million bounty on his head, although he's walking around pretty freely for a guy with a $10 million bounty on his head. So he came into Syria to set up sort of Al-Qaeda in Syria, which eventually became Jabhat al-Nusra, which actually fought ISIS, I should say. And then Jolani clearly sort of dropped the transnationalist goals of groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS and really wanted to focus on his home country, Syria. He had a lot of disagreements with sort of Al-Qaeda leadership. And part of that was the killing of other Muslims. And so I think that, you know, we're looking at somebody that was able to shed a group like Al-Qaeda, remain alive, and not just remain alive, but take over Damascus. So we're talking about someone with real, I think, political skill and ambitions. And so, I think, whether or not it takes the tinge of an Islamist, Islamist faction or nationalist faction, I think one of the real realities that a lot of people are worried about is whether or not he's going to allow Syrians to have the country that they have been fighting and dying for over 13 years. So like a democracy, because, you know, any sort of shade of dictatorship, I think, is not really what anyone on the ground necessarily wants, at least amongst the civilians.
So I want to go, you know, maybe rapid fire through a few different groups with equities in Syria and, you know, that have been involved in what's been going on there. And I kind of want to get your take on what the fall of the Assad regime means for them. So the first one I want to ask about is ISIS.
So ISIS still has several cells that are in the sort of eastern and central deserts areas of Syria. But really critically, there are still prisons in northeast Syria with thousands of ISIS prisoners. There's ISIS sympathizers, and SDF primarily guards or controls those prisons. And when the SDF has felt sort of vulnerable, they play that card. So we've seen prison breaks in the past, and normally they happen when the SDF is feeling particularly vulnerable. So, if the United States tries to withdraw, I think that could potentially be a huge disaster, because whoever gets those prisons and those fighters has a huge bit of leverage on Syria and the region and the world. And we saw the Assad regime use these kinds of fighters as leverage as well, releasing them at times when, you know, it would benefit him because they would be fighting U.S. troops in Iraq or something like that. So these fighters can certainly be used as pawns in the future. And so they remain a really critical threat.
And what about the Kurds?
So the Kurds at least the Kurds that are in power. So this is a group called the YPG primarily that still has links to the PKK, the Kurdistan Workers Party, which the United States and Turkey considers a terrorist organization. This group is probably the most vulnerable of the bunch with an incoming Trump administration who has said that there are no U.S. interests in Syria. If the U.S. troops withdraw from Syria, this Kurdish sort of governing body and forces are in real trouble in northeast and eastern Syria. Very, very vulnerable to Turkish attacks, to Turkish-backed militias, and potentially to Arab tribes in the east as well. Everyone will be fighting for kind of a piece of the northeastern and eastern pie, as it were, in terms of energy resources especially.
What about Israel? We haven't mentioned them at all, but you know, Israel clearly feels it has interests at stake in Syria given the actions that they've taken in recent days. What does that mean, I guess? What does the fall of the Assad regime mean for Israel?
Yeah, I mean, so Israel has been attacking Syria throughout the conflict, primarily, you know, areas where it sees strategic threats. Lately, we have seen it sort of dramatically violate international law by moving into Syrian territory, even beyond the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights and the demilitarized zone, and go as far as Mount Hermon, which is the highest point on the eastern Mediterranean coast area, 9,200 feet. I highly doubt Israel's going to evacuate from that anytime soon, if ever. This is an area that they've wanted for a long time. They've also conducted nearly 500 attacks on the Syrian military. They've noted that it's chemical weapons depots, but they've certainly attacked much more than that, including sort of annihilating almost the entire naval fleet of Syria. And so they've said that this is obviously to shore up their security interests. I think the bigger problem, if you look back beyond the violation of international law, though, is that, you know, Syria is very vulnerable and fragile. And so now it's a country with a new government that has no way of controlling for internal or external threats. So I don't know how great of an idea that is for anybody, especially if we see a resurgence of ISIS. So that's kind of what we've been seeing. Netanyahu has essentially said that the Israeli prime minister has said that, you know, this is to shore up Israel's security, but it's certainly does not bode well for an independent Syria emerging from all of this, because it's quite clear that outside interests are already sort of, you know, taking their stake in it.
And what about Turkey? You know, a country that has long been involved in the war in Syria, but, you know, and correct me if this is an oversimplification, but, you know, Turkey has overwhelmingly, I think, looked at it through the prism of what this means for the Kurds in Syria, and they've based their actions on that, you know, given their fears of the situation among Syrian Kurds exacerbating problems between Ankara and the Turkish Kurds.
Yeah, I mean, anyone that's ever talked to a Kurdish government official about this war, it certainly, you hit the nail on the head. I mean, they really look at this through the Kurdish terrorist threat and their own security interests. They talk a lot about returning refugees, but I think the former is really the critical strategic interest for them. And if they're able to establish sort of a 19-mile deep buffer zone with Syria, I think that's what they're aiming to do, but also to eliminate any kind of militarized Kurdish force or any kind of autonomous region for Kurds in Syria as well. Doesn't mean that peace is not possible. We got close to that in 2015, but it does make things rather difficult.
The last group I want to ask about is Syrian refugees, because, you know, over the past more than a decade, this is one of the principal ways that this conflict's impacts have reverberated well beyond its borders, both in the region and in places like Europe, where many Syrian refugees have ended up. Are there, I guess, kind of any early indications of whether or not, you know, has Jelani said they want refugees to be able to return to Syria? I noticed that a number of European countries have, you know, just in recent days since Assad's fall, stopped processing asylum applications from Syrian refugees. So, you know, I guess what comes next for the millions of Syrians in refugee camps in the region and beyond as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's three critical components to look at. Al-Julani has certainly welcomed back, you know, refugees. I've had some friends that have already gone back, and you see hundreds of thousands of people wanting to return. There's a couple of issues there. One of them is it's winter. Humanitarian aid is severely lacking. Investment in Syria is severely lacking. If you have a governing body that's a designated terrorist organization, that really hampers a lot of the reconstruction that needs to happen, and protection that needs to happen for those refugees. I can tell you, people that I know that were displaced to Idlib have already gone back to their villages, and there's just nothing. I mean, just trees chopped down, roofs have been taken off the houses. I mean, they're just totally looted. The other side of it is that people might be returning to homes that other people live in suddenly because they were auctioned off by the regime or people are squatting in them. And so that could be another flashpoint of tensions for local conflicts throughout the country. So there definitely needs to be some kind of housing, land, and property committee, I think, under the new government to deal with all of that as well. The other aspect of it, which you alluded to, is, I mean, you've even seen mainstream German parties like the CDU, so Angela Merkel's party, saying things like, it's time for them to go home. That's it. You know, so not just the sort of AfD, the far right German party, but mainstream parties as well. And that's really, really concerning because there's a lot of Syrians. I mean, this war's been going on a long time. So there's Syrians that don't really know Syria that well, right? I mean, they've been gone for a long, long time. So, and we've been talking about the uncertainty in Syria throughout the past half hour. So, you know, I think to force people to go back now is very premature, and, you know, illegal on top of that. And one other thing that people have not been talking about, there's an outflow as well of refugees, and a lot of those I shouldn't say refugees, but a lot of those people who are escaping or fleeing are war criminals and pro-regime forces that fear retribution. And so if they go back into Lebanon, you could see them shoring up Hezbollah presence there. Iran as well. You had chemical weapons scientists that I'm sure will be in hot demand. So there's a different kind of person also fleeing Syria right now.
Yeah. Well, to sort of wrap up then, you know, there have been, I guess, U.S. officials quoted as saying effectively that nobody should shed any tears over the fall of a murderous and dictatorial regime like that of Assad. But, you know, I guess those celebrations, I think, should be tempered by the fact that there's a lot of uncertainty here and we don't know what comes next. So I don't want to ask you, you know, to sort of prognosticate and tell me exactly what you think comes next. But what are the things that you're going to be watching in the weeks and months to come, I suppose, to kind of develop a sense of where things are going in Syria?
Yeah. Just to rewind a bit, I think it's hard to underestimate what a historic moment this is for Syrians. I mean, the kind of euphoria and jubilation that I have seen in the past few days is really overwhelming. And I think the tragedy would be if people don't allow Syria to kind of work things out, and if their interventions in Syria are to the detriment of Syria and Syrians, would be a real tragedy after 14 years of this devastating war. So what I'll be looking out for is positive interventions by outside actors rather than negative ones. Like, will we see a U.S. policy that reconsiders sanctions, but in a really thoughtful way, that tries to really guide the new government towards, you know, good behavior, civilian governance, you know, potentially elections later down the line, inclusive governance. We've seen that, but we want to see a continuation of that. And so I think the United States and others can have a real positive diplomatic impact, but remains to be seen if they will do that or if they'll just fight for their guy in Damascus. So. That's what I'll be looking for.
Well, Natasha, I want to thank you again for making time to talk to me today. It's been quite something to watch events over the past few weeks because, you know, after years and years of a conflict that has often appeared to be static, complicated to be sure, but also static, or maybe intractable is a better word. It's been something to watch, though, these events over the past few weeks unfold. And I want to thank you again for sharing your thoughts and your insights on those events. So thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, thank you so much for listening to the MWI podcast. One last thing. If you aren't following MWI on social media, you can find us on Twitter/X, Facebook, or LinkedIn. It is a great way to stay up to date on all of the new articles, podcast episodes, research, and more that we're publishing every day. Thanks again.